Michael, can you hear us? I just want to make sure. How are you? Good to see you. Thank you. All right, dear. Thanks.
Here I am. I'm unmuted now.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to get started momentarily.
I'm emailing you the latest and greatest, most updated PowerPoint. I realize I didn't have my first slide correct. My apologies. And
okay.
I notice I can't send anything in the chat here, so I'll email it to you.
Okay, not a problem.
All right.
Take control and this presentation from here. You can share the screen and we can see it.
Okay, did you hear that?
Yeah, I'll do that.
Okay, all right. So are we ready to get started with him? Okay. All righty. It's at 4 o'clock. It is now 4:01. Well, how you doing, Mr. Gulliver?
How you doing?
You sit right in front of me. You doing all right?
I'm checking out.
Good. Make sure you take a good look now. Well, good afternoon, and thank you all so much for being here. We're getting ready to get the affordable housing panel discussion started today. I'd like to welcome everyone for being with us today. And the first thing I'd like to do is to start out with our introduction. We have a lot to cover today. We have an extra 30 minutes for our discussion. And then if you have any questions, we prefer that you come up to the microphone and ask your questions. Are there any other questions or discussions? Okay, we're going to get ready, get started, and we're going to start over here with our regional council representatives.
Hello, everyone. My name is Marcus Lloyd. I am with the Northeast Florida Regional Council, and I work as a regional planner.
Noel Como, Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Michael Boylan, District 6, and chair of the committee, large committee.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Chiquita Moore. I'm the operations director from the Neighborhoods Department.
And I'm Councilwoman Pittman. I am the chair of this committee.
David Jaffe, professor of sociology at the University of North Florida and co-chair of the committee.
Hi, I'm Shannon Nasworth, president and CEO of Ability Housing.
Jim Kowalski, president and CEO of Jacksonville Area Legal Aid.
And Michael?
I'm Michael Cheney. I'm with Florida Housing Coalition.
Okay, just as a reminder of what our committee is charged for, you know, our scope is to overview the proposal process of affordable housing. We've had great meetings and discussions over the past month or so, and I'd like to welcome the regional council with us today. They're taking notes, and we've had meetings, and at the end of the day, our plans is to come up with legislations and recommendations that would that we can move forward regarding affordable housing. And I also like to welcome Michael Borland, who has been with us, and thank you for giving us an opportunity to talk about the crisis of affordable housing, because it is important, and I want to make sure that we have an appetite to come up with recommendations for our community. So we're going to jump right into it, Dr. Jaffe, which I love. We've had so much fun working together. He is a guy who has his hands on the pulse, and I want to go ahead and get started with you. Give us an overview of what you have observed in the last few meetings that we've had.
Okay, I'll keep the comments brief because we have four speakers, and we also want to leave time for questions and for public comment. I'd like to thank everyone who took the time to show up. Again, we need as much participation and input as possible, and so I appreciate the fact that you've taken the time. We put together a conceptual framework that was presented at the first meeting. If you haven't seen it, or if this is your first meeting, there are some hard copies on the table next to the entrance that lay out the way we've been thinking about the affordable housing issue, the main factors, and the major stakeholders that will shape any kind of recommendations we make. And we are trying to organize our meetings and invite speakers to address all of those factors and to make sure that the stakeholders are here and that they have input. If you weren't here again for the first meeting, everything is posted online. There's an audio of the meeting as well as PowerPoint slides that were presented. We also have been asked to create a SWOT, a strength, weakness, opportunity, threat analysis, and we are beginning to draft that now. We are drafting it based on the information we've received so far and the presentations that have been made. Next meeting, which is next Friday at 9:30 a.m., we have some speakers. We will have a panel, but we will also take time to distribute the draft of the SWOT analysis to get your input, feedback, and let us know what needs to be added, what is missing, so that we have a complete and comprehensive SWOT analysis to put before a larger committee later in the month. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Councilwoman Pittman, and we can get started with the speakers.
All right. So we're going to go in order of the agenda that we have. Before we get to the agenda, I'd like to recognize Mr. Killingsworth, who's in the building with us. So you are on the panel, I think, next time, and we look forward to you sharing information about planning and zoning as well. I also like to welcome our friend, Mr. I guess once a councilman or woman, you're always, right? Is that right, Mr. Killing? Mr. Kelly? Yes. So thank you so much for being here with us today.
I have to apologize. I'm going to leave a little before the thing ends because tonight is Sulzbacher's transformation.
Yes.
I'm a board member.
Yes.
And if I'm not there, Cindy
She will. She will. She will. So we're going to talk fast and get the information out so everyone will be able to hear what's going on. Mr. Boland, do you have anything you'd like to share before we get started?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the opportunity. It's been a long day. This is the third workshop we've held today. A lot of good energy in the first two, and I expect the same today. You know, there's a phrase I heard the other day, and I wish I knew about it beforehand. We talk about affordable housing, workforce housing. They sort of have a shroud over those in some respects. Heard the phrase attainable housing. And I think a lot of what we're talking about here is the opportunity for people to put a roof over the house that's attainable in terms of the ability of their income to support it. So I hope we can kind of think in that direction more. I recognize the homeless issue is focusing a lot on the first two. I think our larger question in terms of dealing with the mainstream of our community, the people who, because it's so broad now, as we learned last time, that there are a lot of people impacted by what's available in terms of the housing distress that they're experiencing. Thank you.
Absolutely. So as we get started, the next section of this agenda would include the scope of the problem of affordable housing, the impact and the solutions, and some best practices that we have. So please, we don't want you to sit back and relax. We want you to jump in and be a part of this whole process. So we have my friend Michael Cheney from the Florida Housing Coalition, and he is a wealth of knowledge, and we can't wait to hear what you have to say. Michael, you're on.
All right. Thank you so much for having me at this meeting here. My apologies, I can't be with you there in person. I'm based out of Tallahassee. And as we go into this slide, just a couple of slides in, a little introduction to the Florida Housing Coalition. But you have right there my contact information on this first slide with a statewide nonprofit, the Florida Housing Coalition. I want to mention another Florida housing entity, and that would be Florida Housing Finance Corporation. This is the state agency most focused on community development and affordable housing initiatives with a whole lot of different funding sources, including the SHIP dollars, which is a source of money that Jacksonville has, and also the Catalyst program highlighted here in purple text. And thanks to that Catalyst program, I'm providing training to you, just like I do over email and through webinars and face-to-face workshops. My coworkers and I are doing that all the time. As a statewide nonprofit organization, we are technical assistance providers. We just recently got done with our annual conference. Boy, we had 1,200 people gathered in Orlando, all of them keenly interested in a subject that's getting more and more attention, affordable housing. And so that's one method of technical assistance and training. And I've already mentioned a couple of others. I mentioned our publications. That's another way, our website. And more, you know, webinars, boy, we're just using virtual trainings a lot more in the last couple of years. We have a data and research data gathering team at the Coalition and informs our publications, webinars, and helps to answer the questions that are posed to us by our affordable housing members and partners. That's a very brief introduction. On to the topic at hand. You know, I want to make sure that the Florida Housing Coalition is being consistent with the information that we're sharing with your area. And so I want to remind you, maybe some of you may remember hearing from some of my coworkers 3 years ago at a strategic planning session. And so in the interest of consistency, I'm going to talk about community land trust and some of the other approaches that we addressed before that got some real interest 3 years ago when we were talking. So again, in the next couple of slides, we'll talk about community land trusts, surplus land or lands owned by the local government, and what can be done to look at local governments' regulations and reform them in such a way that creates even more of an interest and an incentive to develop affordable housing. So that's enough. That's a good amount of topics. On this first topic right here, it's about community land trusts. And the Florida Housing Coalition is now in its second year of a contract with Jacksonville on the subject of establishing a community land trust. So let's get some basic facts out there first. A community land trust can help to make purchasing a home a lot more within the reach of low-income buyers, because it takes out of the purchase equation a very expensive part of the equation. The land that the home is on is not sold in the case of purchasing community land trust homes. Instead, there is usually a nonprofit, that is the community land trust entity, that owns this land, that oversees the development of single-family homes on this land, and sells them to people, again, selling the home, but not the land. You don't sell the land. Instead, you offer a lease, a real long lease, 99-year ground lease, with all kinds of details, as you could imagine. What kinds of details? Because what I just mentioned to you there is not what we normally think about when we think about purchasing a home. It's usually your land, and you usually don't have a relationship with a nonprofit organization this year and next year and every future year that you continue to own that home. And yet, it's an approach that's gaining more and more interest as a way of helping to offer something that's really an alternative to rental housing to low-income buyers. Buyers of homes, but not land. Anyway, what I can share with you is that this project is in the works. There may be some folks in your audience there that are even more up on the latest of it than I am. But in the works, the establishment of a nonprofit to manage this community land trust in your area and to ultimately work with buyers to make sure they're fully prepared, knowing what they're getting into with detailed ground lease that I mentioned. And again, as I mentioned, after they buy the house, for years, to be in a regular relationship with them, encouraging home maintenance and encouraging them to, you know, save money to pay for the mortgage and such. Really interesting approach that could work for some low-income buyers in your area. And so here we go. Some details right here. The latest and greatest is that the nonprofit community CLT is formed and has a board of directors, and public launch was there in the middle of July. Sorry, I forgot I had this slide. So the Florida Housing Coalition is working hand in hand with whoever is staffing that CLT nonprofit and also the city. And, you know, the first step of all of this, as I mentioned, if this nonprofit is going to own and lease and oversee this whole process, you got to start with some land, and land that might have properties, might have improvements on it, buildings on it. And so that's great. Now comes the building homes part, and the good news is in your community, you know, unlike some areas, you have some nonprofits with development experience that can come to bear on this initiative. So homes soon to be built and sold to low-income buyers. I want to be efficient with my time. So I've brought up one subject with kind of an update on something we've shared with your community before. In the interest of moving right along, I want to go on to another subject that, again, was talked about 3 years ago. Let's talk about the regulations of your local government. Let's consider that land use code and any kind of rules that affect how you can build housing, how you can repair housing, fees involved and such. That should be fair game if we're considering reform that might lead to encouraging the building community to build more affordable housing. And so I want to share with you that the Affordable Housing Advisory Committee, the AHAC, is an organization in your area. It's required to exist because Jacksonville receives SHIP dollars, and this is a requirement of the SHIP program. And very specifically, that committee is charged with the task, again, of regulatory reform, you could call it, or to put it a different way, they're charged with the task of asking, are there any rules here related to housing? Are there any rules that should be repealed or should be changed, right, in order to create more incentive for building or repairing affordable housing? Is there any exceptions that should be made to some of the rules when you're building affordable housing? Is there anything in the comprehensive plan that should be changed, the rules for how you can build, etc.? So there is this committee that's in place. I want to hush up for just a minute just to make sure I haven't really blundered. I don't think I'm making a presentation to the AHAC right now. Are there any AHAC members in the room?
Not at this time.
Okay, thanks. So it is for that reason. I thought that was the case, and so I just wanted to say, heads up, it is great, the task that you have before you, recommendations for legislative change, etc. Just know there's another group that's also involved with part of that, with thinking very laser-focused about your local government's land use rules, et cetera. And so I've provided a contact, my contact, Travis Jeffrey, you know, who oversees some of the work of that group. So in addition to, first of all, just reminding you that that's a An ongoing group in your community is responsible for creating a report once a year on that subject, recommendations for what could be improved in our regulations. Let me give you an example, a very specific example of one of the things that the AHAC is tasked to think about. What can we do better when it comes to an inventory of publicly owned lands? That's a fancy way of saying, what land does the city, county own? And could any of that land be suitable for the building of affordable housing? Because if that's the case, perhaps then the local government should consider selling or donating land for the development of affordable housing. Well, right away, it didn't take all that long to explain why the AHAC would have an interest in this. This is totally related to all of our interest right here in affordable housing. And so the AHAC on this subject, at the very least, can say, local government staff, please provide us your most updated copy of the list of lands that you own. We'd like to review it to see if anything's suitable for affordable housing development. And another part of that could be the advisory committee and you and your recommendations could have something to say about land disposition, about how the decisions are made for what you're going to do with that land that you own, local government. And so here's an interesting little chart, a nice visual here on this subject. An advisory committee, I feel like this might have come from an advisory committee, setting out a fairly simple but understandable a step-by-step process for deciding for each parcel of land that's owned. I mean, is this suitable for housing? Notice it doesn't say affordable housing. I would consider it's suitable for the development of any housing. It's suitable for affordable housing. And so sometimes the answer is going to be yes. That's especially what I think folks are interested in. In some communities, more than others, there is a supreme lack of land. And so any available land is of interest to any developer, including those developing affordable housing. So good, we're all excited whenever we come across a parcel where the answer is yes. Let's go over to no for a second. Let's entertain. In the case of no, well, we're not done yet. That land, why isn't that land suitable for affordable housing development? Somebody might say, oh, well, look at this parcel. It's like really, really long and thin. All you can grow on there is spaghetti. You know, there's no way you're going to build a house on there. But is there a cash value for that land? And sometimes the answer would be yes. Go ahead then. Procedure should be then to sell that land and the cash proceeds be used for affordable housing development. Indirectly, but we'll take cash, says the affordable housing development community. So that's of interest, but going back to yes, is this suitable for housing development? Oh, now we're really interested. The Affordable Housing Advisory Committee and your committee might have some things to say about the details of how you go about selling, donating, how you decide when to do one or the other. But in the case of selling, here again, the proceeds used for affordable housing development, depending on maybe the location, maybe it makes sense to sell that land and the proceeds are for housing development elsewhere, or finally, the most direct route you probably think of is donating locally owned land for development by maybe a nonprofit development group, and then sold to low-income buyers. Okay, well, that makes sense. And so there you go. Again, I share this with you. It's definitely relevant to everything that you're talking about, and it's something that's going on right now. That AHAC considering it. They're considering it this year. They had to consider it last year. They got to consider it next year. Every year, they have to create a report. So heads up, they exist in your community. So there's probably a good reason for some connection between your groups. Another task, I want to bring up another task that the advisory committee is involved with. So that you know a thing or two about it as well. The advisory committee, as they're thinking about anything that could be done to reform land use regulations, gets to ask the question about accessory dwelling units. Accessory dwelling unit doesn't really roll off the tongue. ADU is a little bit better, but you know, like granny flat, mother-in-law suite, is what some people call these as well. This concept that on a plot of land that has a single family house on it, you could conceivably build a small dwelling in the backyard, or it could be connected to the house, whether it's standalone or connected. That's an accessory dwelling unit, and we might be interested in that as another source of affordable housing. It's a compelling idea. Not the least of the reasons is it's development in an existing neighborhood that already has infrastructure. So no big expensive infrastructure investment is required. Of course, we don't want to oversaturate any neighborhood, but plenty of neighborhoods that could use a little bit more housing in the form of ADUs. And so this was a concept that we brought three years ago to your area. Well, I'm happy to say that in some parts of the state, there's a little movement on this. We see in St. Petersburg, there's all kinds of interesting innovations over there. But increasing the size of ADUs, of course, they started off by allowing for the development of ADUs, but recently increasing the maximum size of an ADU, and Orlando doesn't require parking for ADUs, additional parking. I just got finished mentioning all of the existing infrastructure, but we shouldn't forget about parking for the people who are living in the ADUs. And of course, that comes with a cost. In Orlando, they've looked at the situation and decided no further parking needed, but a way of increasing the density and the housing availability in some of our neighborhoods. Same with Sarasota, making reforms about 3 years ago. And you know, in several communities, the subject of ADUs might come up. It might be mentioned solely to mention that ADUs can only be available for family members. So here again, if that describes your community, then there might be an opportunity to, you know, kind of open up that policy a little bit much. It doesn't have to be family members, and then that really could open it up as another source of affordable housing. Wowee, folks, I know that's a lot to share with you. Those are some things, again, to be consistent. We've talked about them before in your area, and want to deliver some of the same messages about some solutions and some related housing topics that I think are related to your meetings. So finally, then, the final slide here is, I feel like it might be helpful. I do so much work on the SHIP program, and I know that your community has a SHIP program, so I thought it might be just helpful to give you a little snapshot of how those dollars are being used. Just recently here, less than a month ago, your community and all the others were required to turn in a SHIP annual report. How did you spend money? That would be from the 1920 state fiscal year. That money was provided over 3 years ago. You've had 3 years to spend that money. How did you spend it? And here is your area's report on spend more than $1.5 million. We just have a little snapshot on here. The most important information, I haven't listed off further expenses for administration and such. But interest, isn't this interesting right here? $1.5 million. First of all, one of my takeaways is it goes a long way. 217 households were assisted in three different ways. Some folks got down payment assistance, a home buyer program. So 27 households got some help to purchase a home. 142 households, people who already own their houses, got rehab assistance, home repair assistance. I did my math before this meeting. On average, they got about $7,000. So, relatively minor rehabs. I mean, I've seen some rehabs for over $50,000. But, you know, that's really needed a lot. Just as an aside, let me tell you that in my day job, I regularly field calls from around the state. Sometimes it's SHIP administrators who want to talk to me, and sometimes it's just regular old folks who have housing assistance questions. And I want to tell you, and I'm not exaggerating, the most common question I get is for home repair assistance in Jacksonville. That specific, in Jacksonville. And I, you know, after having noticed this over the course of the years, I think some of it is, and Jacksonville was one of the first cities that was built in our state, has some of our oldest housing, some of our low-income households are living in those housing, and yes, they need some real help. So it's warming to see that recently $1 million was used to help some folks needing that assistance. And then finally, a number of folks receiving foreclosure intervention, foreclosure prevention assistance. Homeowners who, if not for the help of SHIP to help them when they have some sort of temporary hardship, might have lost their house to foreclosure. Anyway, those are the main things that I want to share with you. Your dollars at work, some other ideas that I've shared. I want to thank you for your attention, and I'll hush up to see if there's any questions, comments to flow on with any of the things that I've mentioned there.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your presentation. And what we're going to do is just hold questions to all of the panel members have had an opportunity to speak. And we're asking everyone to, you know, no longer than 15, 20 minutes for your presentation. So our second presenter is Shannon Nazara, President and CEO of the Ability Housing.
Thank you. I go up there? Okay. Let me go up there. It's that one there. Ability Housing. Okay. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay? All right, so I'm Shannon Asworth, President and CEO of Ability Housing. I'm going to do a quick introduction of Ability Housing just in case you don't know who we are. But I was really asked to just talk about some trends we're seeing and then some recommendations we might have for the group to consider. So first, Ability Housing is a Jacksonville... Ability Housing is a Jacksonville-based nonprofit affordable housing developer. We have been in operation since the early 90s, and it was in the mid-2000s that we changed our mission to start focusing on providing affordable rental housing. Our mission is to build strong communities where everyone has a home, and our vision is a society where housing is a right, not a privilege, and all individuals have safe, affordable housing in vibrant communities. Because the housing is as important as the communities, and the housing is impacted by and impacts the communities. We're one of the few nonprofits in Florida that's able to do large-scale rental development, and we really are, because of our nonprofit status and our capacity, uniquely positioned to be addressing the affordable rental housing needs. And that is really what I'm going to focus on, is rental housing. As I mentioned, our mission is affordable rental housing. We're really just trying to meet the need, create the housing that the market can't or won't produce. Can't because the rents of the individuals, the market is never going to be able to help somebody on a
limited Social Security income. They just can't create housing affordable to people with those incomes, or won't simply because they can make more money doing something else. Real estate development is highly risky, and they're for-profit businesses, and they have all the rights to do everything, to what they can to maximize the profits, because risk will come around, and things will turn, and they were going to need to have some cushion for their businesses and families. But as a nonprofit, we're really investing for the long term. Our purpose in doing the housing is the housing in and of itself. We're not doing it to own it for a short period of time and flip it later, try and maximize our returns. We're developing the housing to benefit the residents. We really want it to be a springboard for their future, as well as to be part of a community and to be part of a neighborhood. So when we do build it, we're really building for long-term quality. We really invest heavily in initial materials, because we're going to own it 30 and 50 years from now, and we want to keep it in high quality as long as possible. We operate all of our housing to a triple bottom line. First and foremost, we maintain the physical assets. We are a good neighbor. In every community we've built in, we've been asked by the community to do more, because we really do build high-quality housing that is well-maintained and operated to high standards. The property has to meet the financial objectives. They have to support themselves, and each does. Our first multifamily property was Mayfair Village, just down the street here a little bit on Beach Boulevard, near where it meets Atlantic. And we did a complete recap on a very old, now over 70 years old, property that was highly deteriorated. We completed that rehab in 2011. It is set aside 50% of the units for families exiting homelessness. Half of the units are affordable at 50% of area median income. The other half are at 30% of area median income, and we've never had to tap our reserves. We are very intentional about the financial stability of our housing, because our housing is a commitment to our residents, and it needs to be stable and sustainable. The other aspect, and the triple bottom line aspect for us, is the improving the quality of life for our residents in the community. We really do lean in on providing wraparound supports for any resident that might need assistance, partnering with other nonprofits to make sure our residents have access to whatever services, programs they need to help their family achieve their goals. Right now, we own 699 units of multifamily housing, plus some single-family rentals. And we also master lease some units here in the Jacksonville market, so on any given day, over 800 households have a place to live with Ability Housing. The current value of our portfolio is over $91 million. And we have five projects in pre-development, all of which will close on financing next year and start construction, placing in service in 2024, possibly early 2025, depending on the timing. Two of the projects are here in Duval County, yay! One is down in St. John's County. We have another in Alachua, and another one we're doing in partnership with another nonprofit in Pinellas. In addition to the housing, we also provide permanent supportive housing. That is deeply affordable housing with individualized voluntary wraparound supports for individuals who are exiting chronic homelessness. Chronic homelessness means they have a diagnosed disability and they've experienced homelessness for a long time. They have deep barriers and need a lot of assistance. But candidly, after a period of time, they stabilize, and the amount of assistance and services they need tends to go down. Sometimes not, but it tends to go down. And one of our strategies is, once somebody doesn't need that assistance anymore, and the real barrier is the affordability, is to try to move them into other housing that is as equally affordable, so that we can free up one of those permanent supportive housing units for someone else exiting chronic homelessness. And Housing Link is that program we have to mass release over 100 units here in the Duval market. And then you see a list of the resident empowerment programs. As I said, we operate our housing really wanting it to be a springboard for the families to achieve their individual goals. We don't set those goals for them. That's their business. But among the things we've been able to do is bring free Montessori-like preschool to the community. We help people gain access to state colleges with tuition programs and stipends. We help people with financial literacy and budgeting. It's really whatever they individually need. We find a network of nonprofits and help them gain access to those services. We also have resident advisory councils that we meet with regularly to hear from the residents. What are the other things we can bring to the table to help them achieve their goals? We are a landlord that, you know, we don't want to get into their business. We have a specific role, but we also have a relationship, and we want to use that relationship to help them to the best we can, so that in the end they're not staying in our housing because they don't have other options. They're staying in our housing because that's the choice they want to make. Our goal is not to make people move on. Stable housing is very important. We have retired teachers who have every intention of staying in our housing until it's time to move on. in permanent ways, but we also have other people. This is one step on their housing continuum, and we've actually moved people from homelessness into homeownership through our programs. So here are some of the trends we're seeing, and I know you'll probably hear some of this from Jim, but Duval isn't as bad as the rest of the state. That's good, but we're still having really major challenges. You can see here all of this information comes from the Schimberg Center at the University of Florida. They're very nice to send me updated info, but we really are approaching our mid-2000 boom numbers. And we all remember what happened right after the boom. There was a massive crash, and we are coming back to those numbers, both at the state level and in Jacksonville. So you can see here that our median prices are lower than the state, but we really are getting back to those pre-boom numbers for single-family ownership. We're also seeing massive year-over-year rent increases. It depends on which report you read as to exactly where Jacksonville is on the list, but we're always very high. And that's on this list. You don't want to be at the high end if you're trying to talk about housing affordability. So we are among the highest year-over-year rent increases in the entire country. And here are just some examples of what different incomes can afford, using the definition of spending 30% of your income on your housing as the definition of affordability, which is how HUD defines affordable housing. So a lot of major careers on this list are people who have no option of affording a monthly median rent of $1,400, which is where we're at right now. We also have evictions and foreclosures that are returning to historic levels. We saw obviously very major decreases during COVID because of the moratoriums, but all of those are lifted now, and you can kind of see how things have bumped along as the moratorium changes, and we are right back to our historic levels. And you know, if people lose their housing, one, it goes on the record and makes it harder for them to find other housing, but also it is just incredibly disruptive for the family on both an emotional and financial level to face either eviction or foreclosure. So preventing those is incredibly important, and Jim will be talking way more about that. So I really wanted to spend most of my time on the actions that we can take. And I wasn't able to make last week's meeting, so I don't know exactly how this group has decided to define affordable housing. What I want to say is we need, one of our major issues is the supply and demand issue, period. And when you have supply and demand issues, it crunches on the lowest income persons the most. So we have wonderfully thousands and thousands of people moving to our community. That's great. Our supply is the number of permits being pulled for home building was just reaching pre-Great Recession levels before COVID hit. So we were just getting back to our highest production levels when everything shut down for a period of time due to COVID, and then we had a massive influx of population. Those two things combined just leads to a major supply-demand issue. So some part of the solution is creating more supply and making it easier to do housing in general, not limited to affordability, simply because if you release the pressure at the higher incomes, they will release some of the pressure at the lower incomes. It's not going to create massive amounts of affordable housing, I don't want to say that, but it is part of the solution because there is no one solution to all of this. There are a lot of market dynamics impacting this, and we have to try to address all of them. So anything we can do reasonably to make it easier or more cost-effective to create more housing in general will create more affordable housing in that it will release some of the pressures on it. But we also have to be super intentional about investing directly in housing that is income and rent restricted. And that's the definition of affordable housing that I use. It is housing that has an income restriction. A lot of the federal programs focus on 50, 60, or 80% of area median income as the maximum rent or maximum income that households can have, and then there's a rent amount related to that income that makes it affordable at that price point. When I'm talking about affordable housing, that's what I'm talking about, but honestly, we also need to focus on naturally occurring affordable housing, you know, the older stock that is still decent housing, that is below market because it's older, might be a mom-and-pop landlord, you know, they are providing affordable housing. They might not have a government restriction on it. They might not be getting assistance, but we need to not lose that housing stock as we're trying to address these issues. But there are lots of things that we can do as a community. Property taxes, especially for deed-restricted properties, you know, properties that have a regulatory obligation to serve a certain income at a certain price point, reducing or waiving property taxes on those, you know, really does reduce operating costs. If you reduce operating costs, it makes it easier to provide your rents lower. Impact fees and other fees are significant. Duval isn't as bad as others. I will say this week I was down in St. John's County asking for a waiver or deferral of fees that were over $1 million for an under 100 unit project. They're going to do it for us, so yay on that. So Jacksonville's not as bad as other communities, but we still, every dollar counts. You know, in the end, affordable housing is a math issue, real estate is math, and it's really just making the numbers work so you can reduce the debt that you have to serve on the property and you can reduce the operating expenses, making it possible to keep the rents lower. There's lots of things, and Michael mentioned some of these previously, you know, looking at the parking requirements. And being really specific, you know, certain projects serving certain populations don't need, they will not have as many cars. They don't need as much parking. You have a property on the west side here in Jacksonville. It's 43 units, I guess 50 or 60 some odd number of units of parking. I honestly don't know. I have never seen 10 cars in a parking. I have this massive black splotch in the middle of my property that could be this beautiful green space where people could throw the football and play catch, but you know, we had to spend the money to put in the parking because of requirements that, in the end, really didn't meet the community need. I will say one option, if there's concerns that we're wrong about the amount of parking that people might need, is to allow people to reserve green space for future parking. So we did this in another community where, you know, they weren't convinced that we knew what we were talking about as to how many cars our residents would have on a project that was specifically targeting individual sites of homelessness. So what they allowed us to do was reserve a field. We can't build on it. It has to be available. So if we're wrong, we have to go in and put in a parking lot. But if we're right, we still have a green field and we didn't have the expense of the parking lot. So that's an option of, you know, try to be flexible, try to look at who's really going to be served by the demographics, especially, again, in properties where there's restrictions and we know long-term who's going to be living at these properties. Zoning is a big issue. Setbacks. You know, minimum lot requirements, minimum unit sizes, all these things. You know, we have zoned ourselves out of starter homes. We have zoned ourselves out of the missing middle. You know, we have created the belief that every community needs to be the white picket fence single-family home with a decent-sized yard. And that just is not financially viable if we need the quantity of housing that we need to meet the need. Again, supply and demand. So if we look at reducing the amount of areas in our community that have exclusionary zoning, making it easier to do small multifamily. You know, think of San Marco, think of Riverside. These are vibrant communities that have a wide range of housing styles and types. People want to live there. Having multifamily in and of itself is not a negative. It frequently makes a community much more vibrant and makes it a more desirable place. But we hear multifamily and we immediately say no. And we think it's going to reduce property values and increase crime, and it doesn't. And there's so many studies, and I'm not going to go on to my soapbox about that, but we really have to start looking at what are the things we've done from a regulatory basis that has led to the community that makes it so hard to be more multifamily. Approval processes, development by right rather than through discretionary approval processes, that also makes it harder for community opposition to do completely viable projects that are going to be good to die in an approval process. So we have to work on making it easier, making it more reliable, making it more predictable. You know, talk to a lot of for-profit developers. They're happy to build whatever will make them money. They're not opposed to doing any specific kind of housing. It just has to be predictable. They have to know there'll be a client base for it and that they'll be able to get the return that they need to get for their investment. If we make things more predictable, make it easier, you know, you'll have more people wanting to do things, maybe not the regulated housing stock, but again, supply and demand. We have more people involved in this end of it than the developers focusing on affordable housing can work on this part, and together we'll continue to increase the supply. But there's a big dollar sign on this for a reason. The number one thing we have to do is invest. It's a math issue. We have to put money into this. We put money into very large community, you know, signature projects. If we can put money into those types of projects, we can put money into affordable housing projects. You know, whatever the process we need to do to make sure we're investing in people who are going to work at these signature projects, as well as the hiring people who are going to be living there. It's about all of it. We have to make across-the-board investments. And there are communities, you know, that I think there may have been talk about it actually in today's homelessness committee. But like an example, the city of Orlando got $10 million in ARP dollars. They couldn't do housing with it, but what they could do is take that, use it for eligible uses, and then redirect the money that was going to go to those eligible uses into housing and homelessness. And they basically redirected all of our dollars into housing and homelessness because it's a crisis there as it is here, and they wanted to make the investment. That's just one example. It really does take making it a priority. And it also takes us as a community holding our elected officials accountable to those priorities. When we're doing this, especially the deed-restricted, you know, regulatory affordable housing, being very intentional about where we place it. People need transportation. As we're doing any kind of transit-oriented development, anytime we're talking about bus rapid transit lines, and we ever start talking about light rail, think affordable housing, because once it's in, you will not get affordable housing in after the fact. You've got to make it part of the intentional planning. Where are your employment centers? Where can these people work? Get the affordable housing close to them. It is a good economic development draw. People want their employees near where they're going to work. They know they're more reliable employees. So if we have major employment centers for trying to draw new companies, make sure you're putting housing that's affordable to that workforce near that. It will be part of the draw. And make sure there are community resources. You have to have grocery stores and pharmacies and things like that. You can't have a wonderful apartment community out in the middle of nowhere because the people can't get to the grocery store and the schools and those types of things. So just being super intentional about all of this. You know, engaging our community, both in this room, the broader community at large. I cannot tell you how many times in Indeed Hills very good multifamily deals. And I'm not even just talking about affordable. I'm just talking about, you say the word apartments, and everybody starts immediately being worried about traffic and schools. That word, it's going to be traffic, it's going to be schools. It can be a closed commercial project that, you know, commercial, you're just talking about stores, people are in and out all day, and traffic, you know, trips per day are very high. Make it a housing, they're going to work in the morning, they're coming home at night, it's two trips per day. But people get real worried about the amount of traffic. And it's not because they don't care. They really believe it's going to be something bad that's going to happen, and it's helping people understand that. You know, the schools won't be overwhelmed. You know, these projects increase property values. They don't decrease property values. They don't increase crime. It's really being intentional, and then again, holding our elected officials accountable if the NIMBY is coming out. One, us showing up and countering the NIMBY argument. If the seven people in the room are the only ones commenting and they're all in opposition, that's the only voice they're hearing. So if the rest of us show up and say, no, it's really important, we need this housing, I will personally say we went through this issue, and Councilman Boylan was became my hero. We were facing an NIMBY opposition, and we had seven people who were coming to the meetings, and Councilman Boylan stood up and said, you know, I hear these seven people, it's important, but there are thousands of people who need this housing. They're not in the room, we have to listen to them as well. It matters. It really does matter, and I thank you. And then I will also say, this is not self-promoting, it is a general policy recommendation, it does happen to help, but promoting nonprofit housing development. Florida has a really, really low level of nonprofits that are sophisticated enough to do affordable, especially rental housing, but really any housing. Nonprofits are doing it for the sake of doing it, and they're doing it for the sake of the residents and the community. For-profits are not bad, I do not mean that remotely, but the intent is different, and the long-term investment is different. The nonprofit is doing it for its own sake, so it's going to stay affordable, it's going to stay high quality for the long term, making sure you're investing in the capacity of those organizations, bringing in new organizations to the community to do this is really important, because the communities that really have vibrant affordable housing development in industry have nonprofits that are really sophisticated and able to do this, and we really have to do more of that as a state, but also as a local community. So there are things I put here that can be done. Investing, Michael mentioned some of them with the land trust and affordable housing funds going to nonprofits, things like that. Prioritizing nonprofits, prioritizing JVs with strong nonprofits, not the rent a nonprofit, put their name on the form, but real nonprofit partnerships, so that nonprofits are really part of the deal. They will be in it for the long haul because of the deal in and of itself. And again, I'm not saying that for-profits are wrong and bad and we shouldn't help them to more housing. I don't mean that at all. But if we want a vibrant, affordable housing industry in our community, we have to have nonprofits that do as well and have the ability to not just do the deal, but do the next one. Because, by the way, real estate is really hard and it's wicked expensive. Having five deals in underwriting right now, it's really expensive. So just making sure we're creating the capacity for organizations and bringing in strong organizations from other parts of the country, you know, will really help us across the board. I think that's all I had to say. And I know we're not going to do questions, so here is my email. There's the website. You can email me at snasworth@abilityhousing.com. Feel free to contact me anytime if you have any questions. I will also throw out, although it's not something that this group with recommendations to the city can have conversations about, but what can you, your organization, your church, your civic organization do? Do you own land? You know, is your church going to build a school and it's not anymore and you've got some land that might be a great location for housing? You know, if you, are you building a medical clinic? Maybe four stories above it could be housing. That's affordable. If we all think in terms of what is my business or my sector doing and what is the thing I can do in addition to that that makes housing possible, by partnering together, we can really create more options as well. So I thank you, and that's it.
Thank you so much, and we're going to go and have Ms. Moore, Kachita Moore, who's with the City of Jacksonville Neighborhood Department. She's the Director of Operations.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Much like Councilwoman mentioned, my name is Chiquita Moore. I'm the Operations Director for the Neighborhoods Department. It's such an honor to be here.
Yeah, before you get started, Mr. Moreland, I know you're getting ready to leave. Oh, okay. I just want to make sure I acknowledge you from the mayor's office as well. Thank you. And you're going to be one of our speakers next time. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Moore.
You're welcome. It's such an honor to be here. And I do want to thank Councilwoman Pittman and Councilmember Boylan for having us to come and share some information. So glad I'm kind of coming on the heels of Mr. Cheney and Ms. Nasworth because they've given you a lot of information, a lot of definitions. So we don't really have to go through all of that. I want to thank my team who's here. I call them my supporting cast, Ms. Dawn Lockhart, Ms. Sarah Smith, and Tom Daly, along with Dr. Charles Moreland from the mayor's office. Without them, this wouldn't have all come together. Some of you may have seen this information that I'm going to share today, so it might be a repeat, but mine is going to be extremely abbreviated because I'm only going to make it specific to our Housing and Community Development Division. I want to start out with letting you know what the mission is for us in the Housing Division. The Housing Division's mission is to increase affordable housing to low and moderate income persons in Jacksonville through both public and private partnerships, and that's extremely important. Like Dr. Moreland has mentioned through our other committees earlier today, we thank Ms. Dawn Lockhart for her strategic partnership position, along with her partner, Ms. Sarah Smith, because they have been the glue that has put the city together with a lot of the nonprofit organizations, and we really do appreciate that. So the purpose of this presentation today is to share with you the City of Jacksonville strategies and investments for affordable and workforce housing. This is information that Ms. Lockhart and Sarah has put together from the last 3 years, but this by no means actually gives you a full picture of everything that's been done since 2015. We definitely want to share the narrative with you that's been created, because so many times this information is not available to the public or people don't know where to go to look. So this is our opportunity to display the accomplishments that we've made. Secondly, we're going to talk about the programs that support affordable housing within the Housing and Community Development Division of the City of Jacksonville. And what you'll notice as we go along, the majority of these assistance programs are actually managed by our Housing and Community Development Division. In 2017, the mayor was working with Ms. Dawn Lockhart and a lot of our community stakeholders, and they came up with the Community Goals Framework. This is a national model that's being used across the country to help us define areas that we need to focus on to increase the affordable housing stock. So today, as far as the Housing and Community Development Division is concerned, we're going to focus more on number three, the vibrant and thriving communities, which is enhancing neighborhoods by advancing revitalization strategies, ensuring public safety, and supporting smart development. I won't go through and read this information because all of you are highly capable of doing that, and you'll probably have a copy of the presentation as well so that you can go back and read it for yourself. But these are all important strategies and investments that the mayor has supported since 2015 when we came into office. One of the major accomplishments that we're really proud of is that we have what's called first look legislation. We're the first city in the state of Florida to actually have that. And what that allows is the first rights of refusal for the Jacksonville Community Land Trust, of which we'll talk about a little bit more. Won't have to go into too much depth because Mr. Cheney actually gave you a really good introduction to what the Community Land Trust does. But you'll actually see where some of the investments have actually been directed toward on here. Just to give you some idea about the budget in housing, it actually ranges between $20 to $25 million per year. And essentially what we do is take about 55% of that budget and direct it toward affordable housing. And we can't do that without the partnership of a lot of you in this room. And so we don't want to fail to say thank you for those partnerships. This is just a continuation of the strategy and investments that this administration has actually committed to the city of Jacksonville, and we continue to work hard again with a lot of you to continue to provide affordable housing throughout the city. One of the things that we can hang our hat on, and we're really excited about, the Community Land Trust, as we mentioned earlier, it was launched earlier this year, a few months ago. We've got an amazing board, and the goal is to actually take properties and develop them. We have five properties that is the goal that we're going to develop within the first year. This board that we have, they're very aggressive, they're very smart, they're all very passionate about ensuring that we have affordable housing here in Jacksonville. Again, we do this work through our Community Land Trust not only, but through our CHOTOs, who are our community housing development organizations, as well as a lot of our for-profit developers as well, to provide both rental and single-family homes. So just to continue to add to what I was saying here about the rental housing that we provide for affordable housing, we have about five different funding sources that we use in our housing and community development division. Of all five of those funding sources that we have, each one of those funding sources, to some degree, is actually used for affordable housing. We take a huge portion of that money, up to 55% for this budget year that I mentioned to you earlier, to actually help with that, because we do have a lot of neighbors in our community who need help and need affordable housing. As far as home ownership, another program that we actually offer in the Housing and Community Development Division that I'm extremely proud of is our Head Start to Home Ownership program. Before, this program only offered up to $14,999, which is essentially $15,000 in down payment assistance to those of our neighbors who need help with securing a home. Proud to say that the city of Jacksonville has earned additional SHIP monies, which is allowing us to increase the down payment assistance up to $50,000 for those individuals, and it's to help to keep their mortgage payment below 30% of their total earnings. So we're really proud of that. And our team does a really good job of making sure that we help a lot of our neighbors find housing as well. And just to see the look on their faces, you know, whenever they get to sign their mortgage agreement or what have you, is extremely exciting. Affordable and workforce housing programs. The money that we get, I've already mentioned that it goes toward affordable housing, but we also have a significant portion of the funding that we use that goes towards intervention and prevention to help our homeless population as well. If you all were in the earlier meeting, our homeless subcommittee, you heard about how much of the investments that we've actually put into that as well. You'll see a list down below when it comes to multifamily development. We actually work with the Jacksonville Housing Finance Authority. You'll see up here some of the projects that we've actually worked on over the past 3 years and how many units that we've actually developed. Our goal is, with the funding that we get, is to help produce as many units as we can with the least amount of money. And I'm really proud of the numbers that we've actually produced over these last 3 years, considering that we were in the midst of COVID and a lot of challenges that we had with the supply chain, along with other issues that we had during the pandemic. So on this particular slide, as I mentioned to you earlier, we'll talk, you see all of these different housing investments that we've made. The majority of these programs that you see up here are actually ran by our Housing and Community Development Division. I think it's about two or three of them on there that don't really belong to us, so that lets you know the amount of work that they're doing. But if you take a look at the quantity that we've produced, along with the value of the investment, the amount of money that we've actually spent, that gives you a snapshot to really show you how much the city of Jacksonville is contributing to some of these challenges that we are having with affordable housing. And again, this is our opportunity to highlight and share our narrative with you, to show you the things sometimes that many, whether it's our council members who are very instrumental in helping us with this, without them approving legislation to move forward with projects that we propose, none of these things would have actually have been possible. So we thank them truly for their support in the things that we try to do. So I mentioned earlier about what our goal is with the funding that we do receive. Again, we want to produce as many units as we possibly can for the least amount of dollars, and that has been very challenging through COVID. So just in closing, each strategy and investment, as you all have heard many times, they actually intersect with each other. So sometimes it's really hard with some of the monies that we do share with some of the organizations to determine, you know, how they're actually helping some of those constituents that we reach out to on a day-to-day basis. But again, it's an intersection of multiple organizations, for-profit, non-profit, along with a myriad of initiatives that we have. This data is not inclusive of all investments, like I mentioned earlier, by the City of Jacksonville, and is a point in time of known funding. It includes the fiscal year 19 to 22 and does not include the proposed budget, and the data will be updated this fall. And lastly, as a reminder, the City of Jacksonville offers a variety of programs that support affordable and workforce housing. It includes funding for down payment assistance, as we've already talked about, to create new homeowners of affordable housing, repairs to ensure housing stability, rehabilitation or construction of affordable rental units or homes, foreclosure intervention, and assistance provided to ensure housing and utility stability as a result of the pandemic. So that's all I have today. I know the councilwoman mentioned that we were going to save questions until the end, but I'll be here to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker will be Jim Kowalski from Jacksonville Area Legal Aid.
Good afternoon, everybody. A couple things. I just learned never to share my PowerPoint with Shannon before I go on. Do that again. I don't have a lot of background in this about JALA. Jacksonville Area Legal Aid is actually the oldest civil legal aid firm in the state of Florida. We have 38 lawyers, one of the largest law firms in Northeast Florida, founded in 1932, following the Depression by what used to be, or what was the start of the Jacksonville Bar Association. There are more than 30 civil legal aids across the state. Our region that we cover is actually 17 counties. It's a huge region, although we mainly focus on the Jacksonville metropolitan area, Duval, Clay, St. John's, sometimes Baker and Brantford and Nassau counties. But we actually have three counties on the ocean, and then we have three counties on the Gulf under the area that we cover. And because we're not affiliated with the Legal Services Corporation, we're not federally funded, we actually take cases throughout the state, and our lawyers are known for handling consumer and housing cases in particular all across the state of Florida. We're the only law firm in the entire state, for profit or nonprofit, that has two Florida Bar Consumer Lawyers of the Year on staff. So many of our lawyers are known nationally as well as statewide for this work. And I'm glad the discussion was on intersection, because I'm going to talk about the intersection of housing and our civil justice system. We heard during the first session, and Professor Jaffe covered this a lot, and the focus has really been on rental housing. But we also learned that 90% of Jacksonville is zoned for single-family homes. So I think that was shocking to a lot of us, and I think there's been coverage today in the last session about how critically we need to amend our zoning statutes, our zoning overlay. But that's why I'm also going to talk about foreclosures in addition to evictions. But let's start with evictions. So we have the most one-sided statute in the country. We're considered the most landlord-friendly state in the country. This isn't something we make up. This is something that is brokered and publicized to landlords all across the country as to why they should come here and own property here. Most evictions, most private evictions, this is not true of the housing authority. This is not true of public housing, where there are more protections. But most private evictions start and end very quickly and very simply. They start with a 3-day notice to pay the back rent or to quit. Most of these are for possession only. A landlord can bring two counts, one for possession and one for damages. The possession is the most simple. It's the one with the least protections. The claim for damages actually has more protection for the tenant and more due process. But the tenant gets a three-day notice. If they don't pay or quit within three days, they're served with an eviction lawsuit. And once that eviction lawsuit is served on the tenant, they have 5 days to do two things. They have to file a written answer in court. There are no provisions for assistance at the bar level, at the court level, zero assistance helping people prepare this. We built a website, FloridaEvictionHelp.org, that we host for the entire state of Florida, that civil legal aides and the Florida Bar direct to, that allow tenants to build their own eviction answer. The other thing they have to do in 5 days is deposit 100% of the claimed rent at the depository of the clerk. If they don't do those two things, the county court judge has zero discretion in entering a default against that tenant. Once the default is entered, the landlord presents a judgment, the judge signs it, it goes over to the sheriff when the writ is entered, and the sheriff stands by while the tenant is evicted. It's brutally fast. Now let's talk about those 5 days to do those two things. Let's say there's a storm, a hurricane, and a tree comes through your roof, and your rental dwelling is destroyed, and you have to flee to a hotel, and you're paying your rent money to the person at the hotel. You don't pay your rent money to your landlord because you don't have a livable abode. Your landlord sues you for eviction, even though your dwelling isn't habitable. You have 5 days to deposit the rent. Let's say your house is overrun by rodents, something that's come up a lot locally in Jacksonville. And you flee because your home is unlivable because of rodents, and you're paying your rent somewhere else. You have 5 days to deposit all the rent. There is no discretion here. There's no arguments. There's no excuse. The only way you get to present your defense, the circumstances where you think this is unfair to the court, is if you file your answer and you deposit the rent. That's it. It's very basic. It's very simple. Now, we know a lot about where this takes place throughout Jacksonville. This is an overlay from 2020 to 2021 that combines our case management software with very basic GIS map. We know where the outreach would do the most good, and we know it to a very granular level in Jacksonville. We also know where the eviction filings come from. This is the website of Princeton's Eviction Lab, which I'm sure Professor Jaffe is very familiar with. Professor Desmond, who runs that lab, has a cooperative agreement with the Duval County Clerk's Office and with clerk's offices all across the country. So he gets real-time eviction filings that he then publishes in real time on the Eviction Lab website. So again, we know who the landlords are that are very aggressive in court, and we know where the solutions need to be driven to a very granular apartment complex and apartment number level. Directing folks to resources, once you know the data of who to direct, is the start. And our own Jacksonville Housing Authority does that. This is a copy of a form the JHA serves on its tenants, and it tells its tenants, you have a right to be represented by legal counsel or any other person chosen. You may be eligible for services through JALA. Here's how to contact JALA. Now, one quick point here. We don't want you to change the form, but there is no right to counsel in civil court. We all know that. The only right to counsel comes in criminal court. We don't want you to change the format. We like folks being directed. It helps. But one of the things that communities have learned during the pandemic to a really startling level is how much value that right to counsel brings. And all over the country, you now have right to counsel counties, cities, and even states where there is a right to counsel, particularly in housing court. New York City pays an astonishing amount of money so that every tenant in housing court has a lawyer represented by New York Legal Aid. It's an astonishing amount of money that they spend. The reason they spend that astonishing amount of money is because they think it saves them money in the long run. They save money on law enforcement costs. They save money on social service costs. It's much, much cheaper, and I'm going to show this later on as well, to keep folks housed than to work with them once they become unhoused. And we have learned during the pandemic what programs work to achieve that. In Florida, though, in Jacksonville, we haven't learned that lesson. Florida is now one of only three states in the country that spends exactly zero in state general revenue supporting civil legal aid. We spent more state money flying asylum seekers from Texas to Martha's Vineyard than we do on civil legal aid in this entire state for an entire year. Speaking of Texas, our far more liberal neighbor to the west, as I call it, Texas used to spend $50 million of state revenue supporting civil legal aid. They went up during the pandemic. Now, across the state, there is a surcharge. This is a chart I built in 2018 pre-pandemic. It's worse since then. But across the state, there's a criminal surcharge. We call it the Article 5 surcharge. And every criminal defendant, when they're sentenced, they have to pay a bunch of fees and fines, which is totally counterproductive. But one of the fees and fines that they pay is a $65 fee under this particular Article 5 enabling statute. And that fee is split four ways. Statewide, civil legal aid, diversion court, court innovation fund, and law library. So we get a fourth of that fee in Jacksonville. Jacksonville, though, this is the fee that's collected. I put Lee and Pinellas in there because they're the two counties that are closest to us in population. Jacksonville is the only large city in Florida that doesn't supplement up from that surcharge. We receive zero general funding support from this city. The only funding we receive from this city to do housing work in particular is the competitive grant process known as PSG. Jacksonville may well be the only city in America that funds basic housing work through a competitive grant. And as many of you know from reading the paper, the PSG grants ended last week. We are now not funded by the city to do any eviction work in Jacksonville. We're floating. We're floating that work in the hopes of getting a PSG grant if and when that voting process does finish. So let's look at how other counties work. I've included Miami-Dade, which supplements up to $3 million. St. John's supplements way up. Clay supplements up. Lee, Pinellas, Hillsborough supplements up to $1 million. Orlando supplements up to $1 million for their civil legal aid. Jacksonville supplements up zero. But we know it works. We know that targeted solutions that were driven by the pandemic work. ERAP and eviction diversion. One of the things that Shannon showed in one of the charts was the lowest level of evictions came right when ERAP was ending. Emergency Rental Assistance Program, for those, I shouldn't speak in acronyms. This is targeted payments to the landlords or catch-up money. And we know that ERAP combined with a right to counsel is the solution that many cities, states, counties learned during the pandemic. We did not, but the opportunity is not lost yet. So last week in the homelessness program, Don talked about this cost, Don Gilman. The cost to support a homeless person in place, what you basically are expending as a community to walk past a homeless person, is $30,000 a year. The cost to house that person is significantly cheaper, $20,000 a year. When United Way was running the ERAP program for the city of Jacksonville, their average payment was $6,000. The average cost for us to defend and win evictions is $350. When you combine ERAP with the cost of the right to counsel, it's shockingly affordable when compared with the alternatives. All right, let's turn to foreclosures. Oh, by the way, I added this in here, and I know these PowerPoints are typically made available afterwards. I am a Berkeley grad, so it pains me to quote the Stanford Innovation Lab. This is evictioninnovation.org, was built by the Stanford Innovation Lab, and what it does is it basically says, tell us about your community structure, and we'll recommend an eviction diversion program that works. We'll help you design one. But the basic design principles here on the First Coast would be a local ERAP program and a local right to counsel. All right, let's talk about foreclosures. Not great news. I think Shannon referenced this, that we are heading in a direction that many of us remember in Florida. Florida now has the sixth highest rate of foreclosures in the country, but the highest number of foreclosures in the country. And Jacksonville, unfortunately, is third in the nation in foreclosure rates among metropolitan populations over 200,000. And again, we know where targeted outreach is needed. This is our heat map, again, drawing from our case management software and combining it with GIS mapping software. We know where the foreclosures are taking place. And what do we see ahead? One of the things we're most worried about that we hope Tallahassee addresses this year, they didn't last year as they struggled with the insurance crisis in Florida, but one of the things we're seeing that's most troubling are seniors in reverse mortgages, right? The only way you breach a reverse mortgage is if you pass away or you don't occupy the house as your primary dwelling for 12 consecutive months, or you don't pay your taxes and insurance. And so as insurers are trying to leave Florida and escape liability, one of the things they're insisting on to rewrite older homes where many of the seniors in reverses live is new roofs. Well, they can't afford to put a new roof on their aging home, and so they lose their foreclosure case for failure to pay taxes and insurance. And we're working with some of our state reps to suggest that solutions to this be done at a state level so our seniors don't lose the ability to age in place because they can't afford a new roof and keep the property insurance on their homes. Dual tracking is something we saw during the recession. This is where mortgage servicing banks work with a homeowner on loss mitigation while they're foreclosing on them in court. And dual tracking means those two tracks, and because the two offices often don't consult, they don't talk to each other. And oftentimes our work is a race to stop the foreclosure so the loss mitigation option can continue. Half is ended. I did add this in here. But half is the Homeowners Assistance Fund. It's run by our state DEO. It has ended, but one of the defects in the way that program was designed was they did not use what's called a common data tracking that allows for a half program to talk to the servicing bank. And because they didn't, the servicing bank doesn't know to stop the foreclosure because the half payment is pending or the application is pending. One of the things that we have to work on to prevent dual tracking. Okay. Solutions. Again, the pandemic showed us answers. Just like ERAP was the solution for evictions, and part of the solution for diversion, right? ERAP plus right to counsel. We learned what works. And what we can do here in Jacksonville is simply return to a policy that's pre-2018, that's run by the Neighborhoods Department, and we have half light. And let me show you what I mean. This is the current strategy in use of the vacant property registry in the city of Jacksonville. Now, the vacant property registry, often known, also referred to as a foreclosure registry, when a servicing bank files a foreclosure, they have to deposit a certain amount of money into a registry that's run by the city of Jacksonville. There are 597 of these around the country. They all grew up during the first recession, or the last recession. Not that there's going to be a next recession. The recession. The housing crash. Because municipalities were spending so much money on blight and the after effects of foreclosures that they said, bank, you're responsible for part of this because you're not pushing the foreclosure process through in a normal, orderly way. You start it, you stop it, you end up with these zombie foreclosures where the bank dismisses and undoes a foreclosure years later because they're not getting enough money out of their property. We need some funds from you so that we can pay for code enforcement, so that we can get the lawns mowed. We know that violent crime rises by a statistically significant number on a street where a foreclosure has taken place. We need money to pay for police to handle that. And foreclosure registries were created. This is the current, these are the current two uses that the city of Jacksonville allows in its foreclosure registry. One is foreclosure mediation, right? This is HUD-certified housing counselors, which are startlingly effective. And the second is education. This is Jacksonville's policy pre-2018. Note number one, foreclosure intervention. Direct cash assistance up to $8,500 to individuals and families who are in default or facing possible foreclosure action that meet the eligibility criteria. This is a silent second. We don't want people flipping the house after we save it for them, but it's forgivable over a number of years. This is something the city of Jacksonville could change next Tuesday. And we would have a half-type program that we've already had that would provide, again, just like ERAP isn't a bailout for the tenants, it provides funding to the landlord. Half isn't a bailout because it provides funding to the servicing banks, the foreclosing bank. And it enables people to remain in their homes, children going to their neighborhood schools, families shopping in their neighborhood Publix, all of those astonishingly productive side effects of keeping people in their homes. And we did it up until 2018, and there's nothing to prevent us from doing it again. Finally, and I think we've had a lot of discussion on this, I think Mr. Cheney talked about it as well, the need for a plan. This is just one. This is from the DuPont Fund. They did a block-by-block neighborhood assessment back in 2015. They're about to issue another one. I remember going with Bill Gulliford to the announcement. And we were, I mean, we had, I think I had been on the interview committee. A lot of us had participated in the work. But it's a beautiful piece of work, granular, block by block. But if we don't have a way for this city to have a consistent housing policy, any housing policy, a strategic plan that follows and covers and controls mayor after mayor after mayor and council after council after council, We simply veer. Every year there's a new plan because there's a new council. Every 4 years there's a new plan because there's a new mayor, or every 8 years. Where we see other cities succeed is a consistent, driven, we're all going over here. And we're following this consistent plan because we're all going over here. It took Copenhagen 70 years to re-engineer the city so that 1 million of its residents get to work every day on a bike. Can you imagine the effort, the public consistent undertaking, the buy-in that it took to engineer a community so that 1 million people ride to work on a bicycle? And what do they get? Amazingly low healthcare costs. No pollution. A healthier workforce. Huge side effects come from planning and this sense of doing it all together. But until we have a plan, we're not going to get over there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Councilwoman Pittman got called away for a family issue, so I'll go ahead and moderate. Before we do public comments, we would like to allow people to ask any questions they have of the speakers. And please use the microphone since we're recording this.
Chris Walker here with the Housing Authority, Chair of Housing Authority. So, Shannon and Jim, and the whole committee, thank you. I have a question.
Sorry to interrupt. When you step to the podium, please give your name and address for the file.
Sure. Christopher Walker, 309 South Walker Center Drive, St. Augustine, Florida. You mentioned rent restrictions, affordability restrictions. How does that play into the median rents that still need to be charged relative to the HUD data? In other words, what does it look like? Simply because you have a rent restriction or an AMI restriction, are the rents still skewed in a way because of the increase in incomes in Jacksonville? Do you see a shift in that market coming, increasing the varying income, which means increasing the amount of rent that could be charged under those restrictions?
Yes, I see a change coming. Incomes are going up, so the area median income is going to go up, and the rent is tied to the area median income, and it will go up. And that is problematic. At Ability Housing, we don't raise people's rents just because their income didn't go up, and we have the ability to, but obviously others have the option to increase the rents whether the tenant's actual income went up or not. It is going to be a growing concern and something that we need to take into consideration as we're doing our grand planning.
Laura Pilsen, Chairman, Director of Development for Buffalo Downtown. I'm also the Program Director for Jackson Downtown Council, and tomorrow morning, the Jacksonville Community Land Trust is our speaker. So for anyone in this room that is interested in learning more about what we are doing with the Land Trust here locally, I would tell you to either find me. I think registration's closed, but we would happily invite any and all to come. And thank you guys, always.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Maria. My address is 250 Ravine Street, 2206. I have two questions. My first question is for Ms. Moore regarding the programs that y'all have available for first-time home buyers and things like that to make housing more affordable for them. What are the avenues that the city goes through to make homeowners aware that those programs are available? Is this something that people have to look up by themselves or something that's like required for to be disclosed during the mortgage process?
Absolutely, and thank you for your question. We are required to make advertisements of any of our programs that we have. Also, we go above and beyond at our CPAC meetings. If you're not involved in one of your CPACs, which is a community planning advisory committee, I would definitely strongly suggest that you become a member of your CPAC, because that's where all of the information about any of our programs, you'll actually find that. In addition to that, we have to publish in our daily record information there. A lot of the news outlets, we have really good relationships with them as well, where they will occasionally share information. So, we are required to do that, and we do that.
Okay, thank you. And then my other question, for really anyone that wants to answer, is what is the city doing to protect against the discrimination that folks are facing when they're applying for housing? I was just speaking to a young lady last night that's having issues finding housing because she made a mistake in her youth that is following her around to this day. And, you know, she has a child, and it's not a child's fault that this happened, but it seems like, you know, because she has a record, she's being denied a chance to have housing.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, legal aid.
So, I mean, there is a significant discussion over what's called source of income discrimination. These are folks who have vouchers, and that is currently discrimination that a landlord can do, right? You can say, I don't like those kind of people. You're paying for a voucher. I don't want that. If you're applying for JHA housing, for example, there are restrictions on their ability to use criminal records. HUD has been very forward-thinking at recognizing that criminal history discrimination excludes many people of color. And so if you're going into a public housing application process, that is protected. We actually handle those cases, and we would have a chat with our counterparts at JHA. They don't do it. You can be very proud of your Jacksonville Housing Authority, but if it's non-JHA, we would look at that case. If it is private landlord-tenant, the problem we see is the use of tenant screening reports, right? All of the major credit reports, Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax, stopped using or offering tenant screening a number of years ago because they could never get it right and they were paying insane, completely justified verdicts. The use of substandard credit reports, though, particularly among certain landlords, is a problem. If your friend is seeing that and has a denial letter, what's called an adverse action letter from a landlord that turned her down, and we can compare that with her criminal history, often they will be inconsistent. The substandard credit reporting agency will have the criminal history wrong. They will show a conviction where it was a withhold, or they'll show a conviction where the case was dropped. And then we can handle that from not a housing standpoint, but actually a Fair Credit Reporting Act standpoint.
Well, also on that regard, so in addition to my day job, I just chair the state's council on homelessness, and criminal backgrounds is a major unintended cause of homelessness, and frequently you also get a criminal background when you are homeless because being homeless by de facto becomes the actions you do in your home when you do them outside tend to not be legal. but it is a major issue of criminal backgrounds and credit reports and things like that. It's a major barrier to getting housing. And, you know, we have huge need, and we really need to lean in, and I'm so glad that the council has created this committee and the others on this. I think we should build it upon the foundation that we also have made a lot of progress, and we need to be proud of that and acknowledge that, because otherwise when you beat your head against the wall, you feel like you've never made any progress, it can get really tiring. But we still have a long way to go. And one of the major ways that we have major challenges is returning citizens and the impact it has on their ability to get good-paying jobs, their ability to get housing, their ability to get credit, and all of the impacts that those have. And it is not illegal for landlords to have screening criteria. It just can't be discriminatory against a protected class. And that's where the challenges come in.
And it also has to be correct. I mean, what we typically find is that the credit report, the substandard credit reports by the tenant screening agencies are simply wrong.
I will also say one of the things that Florida Housing Finance has done is they have been instituting mandatory screening criteria that the the owners that get their funding have to adopt that reduces the discrimination. It doesn't wipe it, but it does create lower barriers, and something that the city could do, if it's not already doing, and I don't know if they are or not, and Tom has left, but anything that the city finances, they could also institute similar policies where part of the requirement is that that landlord, by accepting the public money to do the housing, has to have lower barriers for people to be screened in. That is something we could consider as a policy. And I'm not saying the city is or isn't doing it. I don't know. I do know the state has done it very effectively, and the landlords have found that it's not causing any problems for them.
I'm Letitia Harmon. I live on Hampton Park Boulevard. And I have a question for Mr. Opalski regarding a map that you showed over in your GIS data on landlords and evictions. And you said you had enormous accuracy down to addresses that you could tell where the aggressive landlords were and where violations were happening. And I was curious if you were, is that tied to specific addresses, or is the ability also there to tie it to landlords or LLCs who are operating as landlords, and what kind of improvements do you think could be made to that system for us to have full accountability?
So I don't know that I tied it to abusive landlords. That's just simply overlaying our eviction cases on the map to the point that if we were going to develop an ERAP program locally along with the right to counsel locally, we know where those services need to be delivered. Comparing it also with the Desmond map, the Princeton Eviction Lab map, which pulls from the clerk's office. I do think you're getting into another topic that we could improve on, which is that each of our 67 clerks have 67 different databases. And to the extent that we have a cooperative agreement between local municipalities, Duval and St. John's, for example, we could build databases of landlord data, overlay it with Princeton Eviction Lab data and our data, and you would know exactly the apartment complexes that could be most affected by an ERAP program. This would have a benefit to the landlord because the ERAP is making the landlord whole for the past due rent. I think that was the point I was trying to make with the mapping.
So just to clarify, you're saying that map is tied exclusively to evictions, not to any kind of complaint of code violation. Is that correct?
You can do that, and we can. That wasn't it.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Hello.
Are we being filmed while you're asking a question?
Yeah. Well, just so I can go back and just check. No, my name's John Newman. And, you know, I just read in the Special Committee on Critical Quality of Life Issues, Working Group Affordable Housing. And I just want to share just a quick story. You know, I'm not from Jacksonville, but in 1989, you know, when I moved down here, you know, I was just fascinated with citrus trees. And so I planted a bunch of them. And so in 1989, with that freeze that came through, you know, I protected them. I had about a dozen. And then I eventually had about 40 of them. And, you know, I would just have so much citrus, and it just did very well. So, you know, Mrs. Nazworth, you know, with properties, I thought that was fascinating, with parking and then having that space. But then at the same time, I'm just curious with all your properties if you have any citrus trees. And then another issue, and then, you know, Councilman Boylan, you know, there's a public hearing on a piece of legislation, 2022-727, which will be...
John, is there a question in there somewhere?
Yeah, yes. There needs to be a question. Sir. Is there a question for Nazworth?
Well...
Was that a question?
Yeah, well, well, for her...
I have some
questions. Yeah, there's... Well, okay, I guess... When you have time, see, this is why I just... I'm sorry, I apologize. Do you have any citrus trees on your properties?
I don't believe we do, no.
Well, that would be a true, in my opinion, just a tremendous benefit. And again, for those people that are working. Now, the other issue that I'm really passionate about.
I have an orange tree that I can't get to work right. So maybe
you know what? Someone once told me, if it's not happy there, it may be happy there. And you know what? It's so true. Just replant it. But anyway, what I wanted to get to was the waterway issues. And Councilman Boylan, I love the guy. And
is it a question about housing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, all this, you know, affordable housing that we're doing, you know, we're giving away millions of dollars, you know, and, you know, anything with a water waste component. So, you know, is there access to that waterway? You know, and I'm talking about like Hogan's Creek, McCoy's Creek, you know, specifically downtown, and I could just go through a whole bunch of examples. But anyway, right now we got the Armory. You know, that's on the agenda, you know, for Tuesday night, a public hearing. And, you know, that's a 40-year deal. And the previous legislation was 2013-384, and the applicant at the time would allow for public access. And where I'm going with that, with affordable housing, you know, I still do. Go down and fish, shrimp. I mean, the river is a bountiful buffet. So, again, you know, just providing access so people, you know, that may not have the means can just go and just catch a fish, some crabs, some shrimp, and, you know, have a low country boil, you know, with the citrus trees that you can.
Well, what I will say is most affordable housing is not waterfront, but we do actually have one that is in Orlando, and it's a beautiful lakefront property. I would say that one of the things that any municipality should do whenever it's funding a project and providing public resources is look at that project in and of itself. We should have standards and things that we do. But then if there is a special attribute to that project, like it happens to be on a creek where there should be public access allowed, make it just part of the restrictions that are part of the negotiations and agreement with the owner as part of this public investment. I mean, it should be about transportation. It should be about all the community amenities and trying to think holistically about what's best for the residents living there and what's best for the community as a whole in return for this public investment. And I'm not saying the city doesn't do that, but it's something we should always do whenever we're investing public resources in whatever way.
Okay. And I'm just saying the city isn't doing it. But like, there's still legislative opportunities to make it happen. Okay. And thank you for listening.
Are there any additional questions for the speakers before we move to public comment? All right. First for public comment is Wells Todd.
Throughout the presentations, it seemed to be this constant conflict between profits and the needs of the people. We had a situation here in Jacksonville, in an area called Kenite Drive, predominantly African-American community, and they suffered great loss during the hurricane that came through here about 5 years ago. And money was allocated, but from what the public knows, has never been used. So the question that people are asking is, where did that money go? And will it be used for what's needed in that community? The other thing that we keep seeming to butt our heads up against the wall is legislation, I believe, that was passed in Florida that denies the working class or the majority of the people the right to have rent control. I think a number of years ago, lawyers and developers or whatever, and landlords got together and were able to pass a law that says no rent control here. I think that is truly detrimental to the safety and well-being of people who have to rent, which somebody spoke about. Not being able to control these pamphlets when they want to raise the rent $500 on folks who are working 2 to 3 jobs just trying to make ends meet. So I'm wondering if there are any, is there any movement to end that policy, which I think would help the community a great deal. Thank you.
Christina Kittle. You may have an answer to that last question.
Well, yeah, I wasn't expecting to go so early because it's been late. But yeah, my name is Christina Kittle. My address is 4th Street in Riverside. And I'm with Florida Rising. And, you know, we've been working on trying to address a lot of the issues that have been brought up as far as what renters are facing. And one of the things that I just wanted to pitch tonight, and my colleague's actually going to go into more details after me, so I won't take up too much time. But one of the ideas that we had was to establish a tenant bill of rights. And just to briefly go over what that would look like, I'm just going to hit the main points, and then my colleague will expand on them. But it's just 6 major points. The first one being establishing a dedicated office of tenant advocate. So we need a place where everyone knows that that's where they can go to get the help that they need. So that would be the first step in it. And then the second point would be to address landlord accountability. So just one point on that is, you know, unfortunately here, I work as a field organizer. So I use Eviction Lab actually, and we go to a lot of those addresses there, and then we talk to a lot of the tenants who are going through things, and I myself actually went through a pretty bad horror story renting. But we hear stories of like, sexual harassment, racial discrimination. It goes way deeper than some of the things that people would think, including kids who are failing school, actually, because the rodent infestations are keeping them awake, and they're getting bullied because they smell like mold. So it's really taking a toll on the community. But, you know, we just don't really have a way to hold these landlords accountable when these things come up. So we need, you know, something for slumlords and negligent landlords. So landlords that are doing everything the correct way really have nothing to worry about with that. And then the non-discrimination in rental applications based on source of income, immigration status, criminal record, and members for LGBTQ community. I wish I knew to hit you up when I was applying for housing last year, because exactly what you said. I have a misdemeanor that had no jail time, and I just got some community service from 5 years ago that got brought up. And when I called to ask what they were talking about, they pulled up the original charge, which was dropped, you know, down to a misdemeanor. So I didn't know what to do. So I ended up losing out on getting that opportunity, and you know, I myself was facing homelessness. So we definitely want to talk about some of that stuff. And then, especially with like formerly incarcerated individuals, they're 10 times more likely to be homeless, and that's why we have high recidivism rates. So definitely want that. And then one other thing I just want to touch on with that is immigration status. So like the Fair Housing Act in Florida, if you're asking someone their immigration status, you have to ask like everybody. So I mean, the way around that is just to not require their, you know, have members not ask that. Because there's things about the immigration process that people who aren't going through it don't know about, and they don't really understand. So it's really just a way to profile people more so than to understand their citizenship process. But also think about it too, if you're a landlord, you ask somebody who has like American flags all over their vehicle or something, if they're legal, that could be a bad situation for everybody involved. So it's another way to look at it. And then actually, right to counsel.
was part of our Senate Bill of Rights. I won't talk too much about that because Jala did a great job of explaining why that is so important, but that is part of the Senate Bill of Rights that we're pitching as well. You know, landlords in most cases are 81% more likely than tenants to have legal representation. Tenants, it was only 3%. So, you know, it's just something that we definitely believe in. And then the last two were just notice of changes to the lease and fee transparency. I feel like those speak for themselves, so I won't take up too much time with that. And then I'm also glad that the issue of funding was brought up, because there are a few ways that we can talk about funding, but the one that I'll just suggest is if we do adopt a tenant bill of rights and then the office to house it, the initial adoption of it would cost money, but also you have to think if we're finding landlords who are in violation of the tenant bill of rights, those fines could also help with the funding. So thank you.
Thank you.
You have a 2-year statute of limitations under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, by the way.
I did want to just make a comment on one of the things you were talking about with, you know, the landlords who are not maintaining their properties. The city of Jacksonville has instituted, I think it's called a nuisance abatement board. If I'm wrong on the title, let me know. It's new, and it is in response to several multifamily properties that are absolutely deplorable and are just cancers on society.
One of whom we're suing.
Good. And there's a couple more we might want you to work on. But just to let people know that, it's a new body, and it was created to try and help address multifamily properties where they're having trouble with code enforcement being the enforcement arm, but maybe going through this route. And so I don't remember its new name, but the infamous Franklin Arms is the first case. It was just taken up. And there are others, I'm sure, in the wings. So just to let you know that does exist, and let tenants know about it as well.
What was it called?
Nuisance Abatement Board?
Yeah, it's the Public Nuisance Abatement Board.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And my husband sits on it, so if you want information, I'll have it.
If I may, I might also, something unknown, but speaking to delinquent landlords, the Housing Authority, we do keep track of that. And so I would encourage folks to report that to the Housing Authority, which we'll get into next week. But please forward that information to us. That is something that we track and, for lack of a better word, investigate.
Right. And we are focusing here on the bad landlords. The vast, vast majority of them are not. I mean, Lindsay represents an association of good landlords. The enormous percentage of them are good. The Jacksonville Housing Authority is great. We're talking about a percentage. It's just
they're really bad.
It's too big of a percentage, and they are bad.
So we're scheduled till 6:30, so we still have time. I have about 6 more public comments, so if you're going to come up, just think about how much time is left so that all 6 individuals are able to speak. And I believe some more would like to respond to one of the comments, and that's
yes,
fine.
Sir. Yeah. Just so that we can be fair, since Ms. Nathworth did respond to that young lady, I wanted to go back to one of the questions that Mr. Todd asked. The second question I want to let you know I'm unable to answer, but the first one I can respond to as far as the Hurricane Irma funding that we received. That's funding that we received through the State of Florida Department of Economic Opportunity. They gave us about 5 years to be able to utilize that funding. However, what happened, Jacksonville was very aggressive, very persistent about making sure that we did what's called a buyout program, where we were going to try to offer funding to relocate some of the individuals to buy other homes. But what happened, we were running into a lot of challenges with title issues because a lot of the properties were either owned by investors who were not willing to relinquish the property because they didn't feel like they were getting what it was worth, what they were being appraised at versus to what they wanted for the property. The second thing that became an issue for us was some of the properties were inherited from family members. However, you know, there were a lot of title issues with it where the family either could not afford to get it rectified or they just had not done it for whatever reason, or it was caught up in probate with multiple people and the family just couldn't come to a consensus. We are glad to say that we were able to take on one particular property that's under contract right now for about $50,000. This one particular gentleman that's up there that did want to go through with it. Again, the contract is with our Office of General Counsel right now. We will be helping that individual. However, the rest of the funds, because we were almost reaching the time limit for it, we had to send it back to the state. So just to kind of let you know what happened to that funding, we were aggressively trying to use it, but those challenges precluded us from doing that.
Thank you. Maria Garcia.
Hi, my name is Maria Garcia. My address is on file. So I'm going to try to keep it really brief because we have speakers that are talking to the same points, but I want to bring up some more issues about the scope of the problem that we're having here in Jacksonville. The problem for a lot of folks, and this is me included, is the fact that there is an influx of people that are coming in with higher incomes than what we make here in the city, and we are being basically priced out. So a lot of solutions that I think we need to stay away from is not the, you know, the supply and demand. You cannot luxury apartment complex your way out of the housing crisis. We have to just be able to give people housing that they can afford, and not because not housing that has like a 2-year waiting list, not housing that you have to like meet all these specifications for. It's just the people that live here and make this city run every day have to have somewhere to live that they can afford. Otherwise, it's just going to be a city of people that commute to, you know, on Zoom every day for work and no one to run the city. And that's not going to work for any of us. The other thing, this really hasn't been brought up before, but I really wish that there was somebody from Animal Control and Protective Services to come and speak. I wish they would come to these meetings. The shelter right now is absolutely full. They're not, if you find a dog or cat on the street, you can't even bring it to them. And I think this problem is being exacerbated by the housing crisis. And this is a problem that is serious, because if you have animals at large that don't have a home, that poses a threat and a danger to obviously the animals and to people. I mean, like, this is a problem that's like, basically, it's causing our city to start to like fall apart on the most basic levels. And so I really hope that we come up with some concrete, actionable solutions. The Tenant Bill of Rights is one that would include protections for people, not making people like face evictions. That's another reason why they're dumping animals, because they have nowhere to go, nowhere to put their animals, they dump them. Along with other very serious issues that come with evictions. And we need to, you know, hold the bad landlords accountable, but also, you know, there's issues that come with the private developers, such as JWB, that come and buy up houses, and they won't do any maintenance on their properties. So they're forcing people to pay rent and then basically letting the area become a slum, because if you're paying your already high rent, how are you going to pay for the upkeep of a home that you don't even own? So we've got to develop systems to keep these landlords accountable, and we have to do something about the rent. I want to use Orange County as an example. Their city council did put rent control on the ballot. It is possible. It can happen, and it's something that's needed. We have to control the rent, because right now the amount of evictions, the amount of people getting their raised rent $300, $400 just because somebody else can afford to charge that is outrageous. And, you know, we have to control the rent. Thank you.
Thank you. John Nooney.
Hello again, John and me. Well, look, I just wanted to share this with you. You know, I just ran out to the lobby. This is a map of downtown Jacksonville. And you can just go out and get it. But again, affordable housing, quality of life. Right here, I'll just pick up, I mean, we're getting crushed
when it comes to our waterways. But here you have, you know, there's a kayak launch, you know, on McCoy's Creek. It's not even listed on Downtown Vision. I mean, it's like, don't visit Jackson. And then, you know, here again, sitting together, you know, you got 2 hour parking. You know, at least make it 3 hours. You know, the point is, you know, when you talk about affordable housing and people, you know, food is one of the biggest, you know, that should be one of those factors. And so you can have access, but you know what? Like, you go down there and you see all these parking tickets. So who wants to lunch there? And I get back to Hogan's Creek. You know, 2021-0223, and that's, or 221, that was the Emerald Trail stuff. You know, Katie Huss, again, you know, legislation is a dialogue of the community. And if you don't open up our waterways, because I plan on just being downtown and showing everybody, gosh, you know, you got the buffet table opened up here. But this is the map. Go and look at it for yourself. And then also, too, 2016-18 was our fine projects. You know, right across, you have the Orlick. You have the 26 feet of Catherine Street. And then you get back to Hogan's Creek. And I'm all over the map. Well, it's right here. But, you know, too bad Councilwoman Bibbin left. But I believe there was an affordable housing component. You know, this big warehouse, you know, on Hogan's Creek. I think they got like $8 million. But you know, the developer, I asked him, I go, hey, you know, is it okay if I launch my kayak on Hogan's Creek? You know, he said, no. But we just gave you $8 million for affordable housing. And then you go and look at it and it's just clear cut. I mean, it's just wiped out. I'll show anybody. So like I said, you know, I really want to be one of the biggest cheerleaders, but also too for low income housing, give people the access, and again, get back to planting those citrus trees. Gosh, I had boxes, and I also hope Councilman Coyle, not picking on you, but, you know, I hope that legislation is going to be in waterways.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Yes, Tisha Harmon.
Research Director for Florida Rising, and my address is on Hampton Park Boulevard. And I just wanted to thank all of the presenters today and try and add some comments to flesh out this tenant Bill of Rights. I will not take up all the time, but I am available if you want to discuss it more. One of the things, Ms. Nasworth, so much for saying that it is your position that housing is a right, not a privilege. That is Florida Rising's position as well. We think that it is a right to have safe, affordable, and housing with dignity. And that is what we're ultimately working towards. To answer the question about rent stabilization, it is correct that it is preempted by state law, meaning this committee, the Jacksonville City Council, cannot just pass rent stabilization. It has the only way that can be achieved is by declaring a housing emergency and putting it on the ballot initiative, which would institute rent stabilization for 12 months. So that is an issue that takes away power from local government to control costs that might impact the welfare of their community. I think there is something to be considered there, whether or not Jacksonville has reached a point of emergency if we cannot shelter our animals, if it's a public safety issue. There is some consideration to give there, and whether or not it is a moment that we have to actually control the costs so that people can stay in homes. Beyond that, there are 4 structural changes that aren't just reactive to the cost, but that are about protecting tenants and their long-term security in their homes. It was, as Christina has mentioned, I think the first piece of that is forming an office, which could be Office of Tenant Advocacy, Office of Tenant Services, Office of Housing Services. Different cities have called this different things, but it houses the Tenants' Bill of Rights and can oversee things such as a landlord registry, which I would say sounds like we have some accountability mechanisms there, which I'd like to see amplified to a publicly searchable database. Landlords have the ability to research us and to background check us and find out if, you know, we have any tiny mistakes in our past. We don't have any way to check up on landlords.
We don't have a mechanism for finding out if we're renting from someone who deals with integrity, who is in compliance with codes. And that would be an incredibly useful tool to offer tenants, and that could be housed within this office. The other thing that this office could oversee would be a right to counsel program. So aptly described, and the benefits of which I think are pretty evident after we heard the presentation from Jala. One of the things I want to emphasize is that currently, nationally, 81% of landlords have legal representation, whereas only 3% of tenants do. And I think that the cost argument was made, that there is a minimal investment required to institute a right to counsel program so that tenants have access to a professional legal opinion that is countered by the social benefit. But beyond that, I want to make a constitutional argument that this is about the 14th Amendment protection of right of equal access to the courts. This is not equal. We have two separate court systems, and I understand that civil versus criminal follow. But in civil court, we have systems for the wealthy and systems for the poor that are unequal. We are not accessing the court in the same way, and that is never more apparent than in eviction court. And this is why it is essential, it's a part of our constitutional right to have equal access to that kind of judicial opportunity. That's why a right to counsel program is so important. So yes, the cost argument's there, but also just on principle, we should be able to have our day in court because there are few things as essential as housing. And the things that threaten that I need to have the right to defend those. And because our judicial system is so complex and our tenant landlord law is difficult for someone without a JD to decipher, I need that legal expertise. I need that assistance. And of course, it has numerous benefits. Beyond that, I also want to add my voice to expanding non-discrimination and rental applications. We know there are protected classes that already have this, and not everyone knows what they are, however, so I think that when we enumerate attendance for the rights, those protected classes should be listed, and a landlord should provide to applicants for rental so they know that they are able to be protected on the basis of religion, nation of origin, these things. But additionally, non-discrimination on the basis of being part of the LGBTQ community. There are higher rates of homelessness, especially among youth, for gay and trans individuals. And they have as much right to dignified housing as anyone else, and that right must be protected. Also, for returning citizens who are 10 times more likely to be homeless, they need barriers taken away to getting into employment, to getting into housing. There is the cost argument to make for this. This is actually a public safety argument. There are lower rates of recidivism of re-arrest when returning citizens have access to housing. So this is actually moving towards public safety. And then, of course, but then it is also just the argument of human dignity. This is a person who has served their time, who is trying to re-enter society as a productive member, and they need housing. So we need to remove the barriers that stand against them. Additionally, I want to mention immigration status for the same reasons the general public doesn't understand. I have people in my family who have gone through the immigration process, and at various points, no one had any clue what their status meant, didn't know if they were here legally or not. And it is also part of the Fair Housing Act that you cannot, that if you're going to ask anyone, you have to ask everyone about immigration status. And so what we're proposing is actually that you ask no one, because most people don't know how to decipher the answer to immigration status anyway, since they're not familiar with that whole system. Lastly, I just want to mention that the notice of changes to lease would be another way to help with that predictability in the market that we talked about, with tenants knowing what's coming up. So a 60-day notice before there is a rent increase that is greater than 5%, that is permitted by state law, and that would be a benefit to renters to know what's coming, to know if their rent is going to go up and to have time to prepare. And also a 90-day notice of termination of lease. So that, again, if they're going to lose their home, their place that they live, they have opportunity, they have enough time to prepare and to find alternatives. So I thank you again so much for the presentations and for amplifying the need for this. I hope that a full package that achieves this kind of structural change and that enforces existing state law will be considered and recommended by this committee.
Thank you. Rozier, I'm not sure if I'm reading this correctly. R-O-S-U-R-E. Maybe they left the building. All right, Jesse Spradley.
Dr. Jaffe, it's the lady sitting in the back over here.
Yeah.
Yes. It's yes.
I remember.
I could not read this. So we have 15 minutes. So think about the other person who would like to make a public comment, please.
My name is Rosella Nostrand, and I live at 32205. People have pretty much said everything I'm thinking, and it was very informative and interesting. I have to say, the thing that I'm just gobsmacked about is the fact that we send money back. Oh, my God, that's insanity. We are so broken. Kenite money never got out there. You know, we were delivering sandbags out there again 2 weeks ago. That's just unspeakable neglect. You know, these are our most vulnerable. These are them. These are why we're in the room, because of people in need that have been ignored for generations. Can I drive? We had the money in our hands, and it went back because we couldn't figure out how to get it to people. I'm sorry, I just don't get it. I'm just not smart enough to wrap my head around it. So if anyone can explain that to me in the near future, I'd appreciate it, because I'm just not educated enough. I don't understand what you're all talking about. So I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Jesse Spradley.
Hello, Jesse Spradley. I'm with the Northeast Florida Builders Association, 6747 South Point Parkway, Jacksonville, Florida. I just want to say thank you to all of our presenters. Everyone was fantastic, but I specifically want to rise and support the recommendations that came from FHC and Ability Housing that would allow for market rate solutions and market rate builders and developers to help with the access to housing. I thought, in fact, I have a lovely long list here. I'm not going to read it, but just about every comment that was on Ms. Nasworth's and Mr. Cheney's list was on our list. I really wanted to punch home something Ms. Nasworth said, though, about, I phrase it, NIMBY-proofing your zoning and the land development code. You got to protect, it's so hard to get those affordable housing projects approved, and you can do that by allowing them by right and allowing that flexibility by right. So when we go into this discussion about zoning, that's what we need to be considering. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. That's the public comment segment. And that is the conclusion. I'd like to thank our speakers. Michael Cheney, still there, Michael?
Here I am.
All right. Thanks for hanging in. And Shannon Nasworth, Chiquita Moore, James Kowalski, thank you very much for sharing your insights, information, and recommendations. And we will be following up on those and probably be back in touch with you with further questions. I'd like to thank all of you for attending. And the next meeting is next Friday at 9:30 a.m. And at that meeting, we will have several speakers. We hope to have a panel of tenants and renters in Jacksonville who can share their experience. And we will also be distributing a draft of the SWOT analysis for your input and feedback. So thank you again, all of you, for taking the time to attend. We'll see you, hopefully, next Friday.
You embarrass yourself. I don't. We're talking about affordable housing. We're not talking about lottery. Kayak.
Let me explain it to you. We were working with the state, and just like we work with the federal government, whenever we have any grants, there are criteria that we have to meet.
Oh my gosh, everything on the
It took us almost a year to get the contract to come to an agreement with GEO. When they came back, we had not met any benchmarks.
It's one of my dear friends.
He was my the hero.
You must be so frustrated. So you get this money to help your community.
Yeah, this is
the time.
No worries. I think your information was on the.
A year went by before
as we're going through everything because we had the.
I know.